He reached out and took hold of my head with both his hands. "You want this?" He brought my head down slowly until my forehead pressed his nose. Tempi let go of my head.
"Striking with the head is quick. For me, little time. Can I move?"
He moved my head down as he pulled away, and this time my forehead came into contact with his mouth instead, as if he were giving me a kiss.
"This is not good. The mouth is soft."
He tipped my head back again.
"If I am very fast..."
He took a full step back and brought my head down farther until my forehead touched his chest. He let me go, and I stood back up.
"This is still not good. My chest is not soft, but this man has a head harder than many."
His eyes twinkled a little, and I chuckled, realizing he had made a joke.
"So," Tempi said, stepping back to where we were before, "what can Tempi do?"
He motioned.
"Strike with the head. Slow. I show."
Vaguely nervous, I brought my head down slowly as if trying to break his nose. Matching my slow speed, Tempi leaned forward and tucked his chin a bit. It wasn't much of a change, but this time, as I brought my head down, my nose met the top of his head. Tempi stepped back.
"See? Cleverness. Not mad thinking word fire."
"It was very fast," I said, feeling slightly embarrassed. "I could not see."
"Yes, fighting is fast. Train to be fast. Train, not word fire."
He gestured earnest and met my eye, a rarity for him.
"I tell this because you are the leader. You need the knowing. If you think I have secret ways and iron skin..."
He looked away, shaking his head. Dangerous. We both sat back down next to our packs. "I heard it in a story," I said by way of explanation. "A story like we tell around the fire at night."
"But you..." He pointed to me. "You have fire in your hands. You have..."
He snapped his fingers, then made a gesture like a fire roaring up suddenly.
"You have the doing of this, and you think the Adem have word fires inside?"
I shrugged. "That is why I ask of the Lethani. It seems mad, but I have seen mad things be true, and I am curious." I hesitated before asking my other question. "You said, who knows the Lethani cannot lose a fight?"
"Yes, but not with word fires. The Lethani is a type of knowing."
Tempi paused, obviously considering his words carefully.
"Lethani is most important thing. All Adem learn. Mercenary learn twice. Cheyenne learn three times. Most important. But complicated. Lethani is many things, but nothing touched or pointed to. Adem spend whole lives thinking on the Lethani. Very hard. Problem," he said. "It is not my place to teach my leader, but you are my student in language. Women teach the Lethani. I am not such. It is a part of civilization, and you are a barbarian."
Gentle sorrow.
"But you want to be civilization, and you have need of the Lethani."
"Explain it," I said. "I will try to understand." He nodded.
"The Lethani is doing right things."
I waited patiently for him to continue. After a minute, he gestured. Frustration.
"Now you ask questions."
He took a deep breath and repeated.
"The Lethani is doing right things."
I tried to think of an archetypal example of something good. "So, the Lethani is giving a hungry child food to eat?" He made a wavering motion that meant yes and no.
The Lethani is not doing a thing. Lethani is the thing that shows us.
Lethani means rules? Laws? Tempi shook his head.
No.
He gestured to the forest around us.
Law is from outside, controlling. It is the horse mouth metal and the head strings.
Questioning. Bridle and bit? I suggested, motioning as if pulling a horse's head about with a pair of reins.
Yes, law is bridle and bit. It controls from outside. The Lethani,
he pointed between his eyes, then at his chest,
lives inside. Lethani helps decide. Law is made because many have no understanding of Lethani.
So, with the Lethani, a person does not need to follow the law. Pause.
Perhaps.
Frustration. He drew out his sword and held it parallel to the ground, its edge pointing up.
If you were small, walking this sword would be like the Lethani.
Painful for feet? I asked, trying to lighten the mood a bit. Amusement. Anger. Disapproval.
No. Difficult to walk. Easy to fall on one side. Difficult to stay.
The Lethani is very straight?
No.
Pause.
What is it called when there is many mountain and one place for walking?
A path? A pass?
Pass.
Tempi nodded.
The Lethani is like a pass in the mountains. Bends. Complicated. Pass is easy way through. Only way through. But not easy to see. Path that is easy much times not go through mountains. Sometimes goes nowhere. Starve. Fall onto hole.
So, the Lethani is the right way through the mountains. Partial agreement. Excitement.
It is the right way through the mountains. But the Lethani is also knowing the right way. Both. And mountains are not just mountains. Mountains are everything.
So, the Lethani is civilization? Pause. Yes and no. Tempi shook his head, frustrated. I thought back to what he had said about mercenaries having to learn the Lethani twice. Is the Lethani fighting? I asked.
No.
He said this with such absolute certainty that I had to ask the opposite to make sure. Is the Lethani not fighting?
No. One who knows the Lethani knows when to fight and not fight.
Very important. I decided to change directions. Was it of the Lethani for you to fight today?
Yes. To show Adam is not afraid. We know with barbarians, not fighting is coward. Coward is weak, not good for them to think. So with many watching, fight. Also to show one Adam is worth many.
What if they had won?
Then barbarians know Tempi is not worth many. No. If you fall and break a leg in Mountain Pass, it is still the pass. If I fail while following the Lethani, it is still the Lethani.
Serious.
This is why we are talking now. Today, with your knife, that was not the Lethani. It was not a right thing.
I was afraid you would be hurt.
The Lethani does not put down roots in fear,
he said, sounding as if he were reciting. Would it be the Lethani to let you be hurt? A shrug.
Perhaps.
Would it be of the Lethani to let you be, extreme emphasis, hurt?
Perhaps. No, but they did not. To be first with the knife is not of the Lethani. If you win and are first with the knife, you do not win.
Vast disapproval. I couldn't puzzle out what he meant by the last. I don't understand, I said.
The Lethani is right action, right way, right time.
Tempi's face suddenly lit up.
The old trader man, he said with visible enthusiasm, in the stories with the packs, what is the word?
Tinker?
Yes, the tinker. How you must treat such men.
I knew, but I wanted to see what the Adem thought. How? He looked at me, his fingers pressing together, irritation.
You must be kind, and help them, and speak well, always polite, always.
I nodded. And if they offer something, you must consider buying it. Tempi made a triumphant gesture.
Yes, you can do many things when meeting Tinker, but there is only one right thing.
He calmed himself a little. Caution.
But only doing is not the Lethani. First knowing, then doing, that is the Lethani.
I thought on this for a moment. So, being polite is the Lethani?
Not polite, not kind, not good, not duty. The Lethani is none of these. Each moment, each choice, all different.
He gave me a penetrating look.
Do you understand?
No. Happiness. Approval. Tempi got to his feet, nodding.
It is good you know you do not. Good that you say. That is also of the Lethani.
Chapter 88. Listening. Tempi and I returned to find the camp surprisingly cheerful. Daydan and Hespa were smiling at each other, and Martin had managed to shoot a wild turkey for dinner. So we ate and joked. And after the washing up was done, Hespa told her story about the boy who loved the moon, starting again at the beginning. Daydan kept his mouth miraculously shut, and I dare to hope our little group was finally starting to become a team.
Jax had no trouble following the moon, because in those days, the moon was always full. She hung in the sky, round as a cup, bright as a candle, all unchanging. Jax walked for days and days until his feet grew sore. He walked for months and months, and his back grew tired beneath his packs. He walked for years and years and grew up tall and lean and hard and hungry. When he needed food, he traded out of the Tinker's packs. When his shoes wore thin, he did the same. Jax made his own way, and he grew up clever and sly. Through it all, Jax thought about the moon. When he began to think he couldn't go another step, he'd put on his spectacles and look up at her, round-bellied in the sky. And when he saw her, he would feel a slow stirring in his chest. And in time, he came to think he was in love. Eventually, the road Jax followed passed through Tinue, as all roads do. Still, he walked, following the great stone road east toward the mountains. The road climbed and climbed. He ate the last of his bread and the last of his cheese. He drank the last of his water and the last of his wine. He walked for days without either, the moon growing larger in the night sky above him. Just as his strength was failing, Jax climbed over a rise and found an old man sitting in the mouth of a cave. He had a long gray beard and a long gray robe. He had no hair on the top of his head or shoes on the bottom of his feet. His eyes were open and his mouth was closed. His face lit up when he saw Jax. He came to his feet and smiled.
"Hello, hello!"
he said, his voice bright and rich.
"You're a long way from anywhere. How is the road to Tinue?"
"It's long," Jax said, "and hard and weary." The old man invited Jax to sit. He brought him water and goat's milk and fruit to eat. Jax ate hungrily, then offered the man a pair of shoes from his pack in trade.
"No need, no need," the old man said happily, wiggling his toes. "But thanks for offering all the same."
Jack shrugged.
"As you will. But what are you doing here, so far from everything?"
"I found this cave when I was out chasing the wind," the old man said. "I decided to stay because this place is perfect for what I do."
"And what is that?"
Jax asked.
"I am a listener," the old man said. "I listen to things to see what they have to say."
"Ah," Jack said carefully. "And this is a good place for that?"
"Quite good, quite excellent good," the old man said. "You need to get a long ways away from people before you can learn to listen properly."
He smiled.
"What brings you out to my little corner of the sky?"
"I am trying to find the moon."
"That's easy enough,"
the old man said, gesturing to the sky.
"We see her most every night, weather permitting."
"No, I'm trying to catch her. If I could be with her, I think I could be happy."
The old man looked at him seriously.
"You want to catch her, do you? How long have you been chasing?"
"More years and miles than I can count."
The old man closed his eyes for a moment, then nodded to himself.
"I can hear it in your voice. This is no passing fancy."
He leaned close and pressed his ear to Jax's chest. He closed his eyes for another long moment and was very still.
"Ooh," he said softly. "How sad. Your heart is broken, and you've never even had a chance to use it."
Jax moved around, a little uncomfortable.
"If you don't mind my asking,"
Jax said,
"what's your name?"
"I don't mind you asking," the old man said, "so long as you don't mind me not telling. If you had my name, I'd be under your power, wouldn't I?"
"Would you?"
Jax asked.
"Of course,"
the old man frowned.
"That is the way of things, though you don't seem to be much for listening. It's best to be careful. If you managed to catch hold of even just a piece of my name, you'd have all manner of power over me."
Jax wondered if this man might be able to help him. While he didn't seem to be terribly ordinary, Jax knew he was on no ordinary errand. If he'd been trying to catch a cow, he would ask a farmer's help. But to catch the moon, perhaps he needed the help of an odd old man.
"You said you used to chase the wind,"
Jax said.
"Did you ever catch it?"
"In some ways, yes,"
the old man said.
"And in other ways, no. There are many ways of looking at that question, you see."
"Could you help me catch the moon?"
"I might be able to give you some advice," the old man said reluctantly. "But first, you should think this over, boy. When you love something, you have to make sure it loves you back, or you'll bring about no end of trouble chasing it."
Hespa didn't look at Daydan as she said this. She looked everywhere in the world but at him. Because of this, she didn't see the stricken, helpless look on his face.
"How can I find out if she loves me?" Jax asked.
"You could try listening,"
the old man said, almost shyly.
"It works wonders, you know. I could teach you how."
"How long would that take?"
"A couple years," the old man said. "Give or take. It depends on if you have a knack for it. It's tricky, proper listening, but once you have it, you'll know the moon down to the bottoms of her feet."
Jack shook his head.
"Too long. If I can catch her, I can talk with her. I can make..."
"Well, that's part of your problem right there,"
the old man said.
"You don't really want to catch her. Not really. Will you trail her through the sky? Of course not. You want to meet her. That means you need the moon to come to you."
"How can I do that?"
he said. The old man smiled.
"Well, that's the question, isn't it? What do you have that the moon might want?
What do you have to offer the moon?
Only what I have in these packs.
That's not quite what I meant, the old man muttered. But we might as well take a look at what you've brought, too.
The old hermit looked through the first pack and found many practical things. The contents of the second pack were more expensive and rare, but no more useful. Then the old man saw the third pack.
And what do you have in there?
I've never been able to get it open, Jack said. The knot is too much for me. The hermit closed his eyes for a moment, listening. Then he opened his eyes and frowned at Jack's.
The knot says you tore at it, pricked it with a knife, bit it with your teeth.
Jack was surprised.
I did,
he admitted.
I told you I tried everything to get it open.
Hardly everything,
the hermit said scornfully. He lifted the pack until the knotted cord was in front of his face.
I'm terribly sorry,
he said.
But would you open up?
He paused.
Yes, I apologize. He won't do it again.
The knot unraveled, and the hermit opened the pack. Looking inside, his eyes widened, and he let out a low whistle. But when the old man spread the pack open on the ground, Jax's shoulders slumped. He had been hoping for money, or gems, some treasure he could give the moon as a gift. But all the pack held was a bent piece of wood, a stone flute, and a small iron box. Of these, only the flute caught Jax's attention. It was made of a pale green stone.
I had a flute when I was younger, Jack said. But it broke, and I could never make it right again.
They're all quite impressive, the hermit said.
The flute is nice enough, Jack said with a shrug. But what use is a piece of wood in a box too small for anything practical?
The hermit shook his head.
Can't you hear them? Most things whisper. These things shout.
He pointed at the piece of crooked wood.
That is a folding house, unless I miss my guess. Quite a nice one, too.
What's a folding house?
You know how you can fold a piece of paper on itself, and each time it gets smaller?
The old man gestured at the piece of crooked wood.
A folding house is like that, except it's a house, of course.
Jax took hold of the piece of crooked wood and tried to straighten it. Suddenly, he was holding two pieces of wood that resembled the beginning of a door frame.
Don't unfold it here!
The old man shouted.
I don't want a house outside my cave blocking my sunlight.
Jax tried to push the two pieces of wood back together.
Why can't I fold it back up?
Because you don't know how, I expect,
the old man said plainly.
I suggest you wait until you know where you want it before you unfold it the rest of the way.
Jack set the wood down carefully, then picked up the flute.
Is this special too?
He put it to his lips and blew a simple trill like a Will's widow.
Hesper smiled teasingly, lifted a familiar wooden whistle to her lips and blew, ta-ta-dee, ta-ta-dee.
Now everyone knows the Will's widow is also called a nightjar, so it isn't out when the sun is shining. Despite this, a dozen nightjars flew down and landed all around Jax, looking at him curiously and blinking in the bright sunlight.
It seems to be more than the usual flute,
the old man said.
And the box?
Jax reached out and picked it up. It was dark and cold and small enough that he could close his hand around it. The old man shivered and looked away from the box.
It's empty.
How can you tell without seeing inside?
By listening,
he said.
I'm amazed you can't hear it yourself. It's the emptiest thing I've ever heard. It echoes. It's meant for keeping things inside.
All boxes are meant for keeping things inside.
And all flutes are meant to play beguiling music,
the old man pointed out.
But this flute is more so. The same is true with this box.
Jax looked at the box for a moment, then set it down carefully and began to tie up the third pack with the three treasures inside it.
I think I'll be moving on, Jax said.
Are you sure you won't consider staying for a month or two?
The old man said.
You could learn to listen just a bit more closely. Useful thing, listening.
You've given me some things to think about, Jack said. And I think you're right. I shouldn't be chasing the moon. I should make the moon come to me.
That's not what I actually said,
the old man murmured. But he did so in a resigned way. Skilled listener that he was, he knew he wasn't being heard. Jax set off the next morning, following the moon higher into the mountains. Eventually, he found a large, flat piece of ground nestled high among the tallest peaks. Jax brought out the crooked piece of wood and piece by piece began to unfold the house. With the whole night in front of him, he was hoping to have it finished well before the moon began to rise. But the house was much larger than he had guessed, more a mansion than a simple cottage. What's more, unfolding it was more complicated than he had expected. By the time the moon reached the top of the sky, he was still far from being finished. Perhaps Jax hurried because of this. Perhaps he was reckless. Or perhaps it was just that Jax was unlucky as ever. In the end, the result was the same. The mansion was magnificent, huge and sprawling. But it didn't fit together properly. There were stairways that led sideways instead of up. Some rooms had too few walls, or too many. Many rooms had no ceiling, and high above they showed a strange sky full of unfamiliar stars. Everything about the place was slightly skewed. In one room, you could look out the window at the springtime flowers, while across the hall, the windows were filmed with winter's frost. It could be time for breakfast in the ballroom, while twilight filled a nearby bedroom. Because nothing in the house was true, none of the doors or windows fit tight. They could be closed, even locked, but never made fast. And as big as it was, the mansion had a great many doors and windows, so there were a great many ways both in and out. Jax paid no mind to any of this. Instead, he raced to the top of the highest tower and put the flute to his lips. He poured out a sweet song into the clear night sky. No simple bird trill. This was a song that came from his broken heart. It was strong and sad. It fluttered like a bird with a broken wing. Hearing it, the moon came down to the tower. Pale and round and beautiful, she stood before Jax in all her glory, and for the first time in his life, he felt a single breath of joy. They spoke then, on the top of the tower. Jax telling her of his life, his wager, and his long, lonely journey. The moon listened and laughed and smiled. But eventually, she looked longingly toward the sky. Jax knew what this foretold.
Stay with me, he pleaded. I can only be happy if you're mine.
I must go, she said. The sky is my home.
I have made a home for you, Jax said, gesturing to the vast mansion below them. There is sky enough for you here, an empty sky that is all for you.
I must go, she said. I have been away too long. He raised his hand as if to grab her, then stopped himself.
Time is what we make it here, he said. Your bedroom can be winter or spring, all according to your desire.
I must go, she said, looking upward, but I will return. I am always and unchanging, and if you play your flute for me, I will visit you again.
I have given you three things, he said, a song, a home, and my heart. If you must go, will you not give me three things in return?
She laughed, holding her hands out to her sides. She was naked as the moon. What do I have that I can leave with you? But if it is mine to give, ask, and I will give it. Jax found his mouth was dry.
First, I would ask for a touch of your hand.
One hand clasps another, and I grant you your request. She reached out to him, her hand smooth and strong. At first it seemed cool, then marvelously warm. Goose flesh ran all up and down Jax's arms.
Second, I would beg a kiss, he said.
One mouth tastes another, and I grant you your request. She leaned in close to him. Her breath was sweet, her lips firm as fruit. The kiss pulled the breath out of Jax, and for the first time in his life, his mouth curved into the beginning of a smile. "And what is the third thing?" the moon asked. Her eyes were dark and wise. Her smile was full and knowing.
"Your name," Jax breathed, "that I might call you by it."
"One body," the moon began, stepping forward eagerly. Then she paused. "Only my name?" she asked, sliding her hand around his waist. Jax nodded. She leaned close and spoke warmly against his ear.
"Ludus."
And Jax brought out the black iron box, closing the lid and catching her name inside.
"Now I have your name," he said firmly. "So I have mastery over you, and I say you must stay with me forever so I can be happy."
And so it was. The box was no longer cold in his hand. It was warm, and inside he could feel her name fluttering like a moth against a window pane. Perhaps Jax had been too slow in closing the box. Perhaps he fumbled with the clasp, or perhaps he was simply unlucky in all things. But in the end, he only managed to catch a piece of the moon's name, not the thing entire. So Jax could keep her for a while, but she always slips away from him. Out from his broken mansion, back to our world. But still, he has a piece of her name, and so she always must return.
Hesper looked around at us, smiling.
"And that is why the moon is always changing, and that is where Jax keeps her when she is not in our sky. He caught her, and he keeps her still. But whether or not he is happy is only for him to know."
There was a long moment of silence.
"That," Daydan said, "is one hell of a story."
Hesper looked down, and though the firelight made it difficult to tell, I would have bet a penny she was blushing. Hard Hesper, who I wouldn't have guessed had a drop of blushing in her.
"It took me a long time to remember all of it," she said. "My mother used to tell it to me when I was a little girl. Every night, always the same. Said she learned it from her mother."
"Well, you'll need to make sure you tell your daughters too," Daydan said. "A story like that is too good to let fall by the roadside."
Hesper smiled. Unfortunately, that peaceful evening was like the lull that comes in the center of a storm. The next day, Hesper made a comment that sent Daydan off in a huff, and for 2 hours they could barely look at each other without hissing like angry cats. Daydan tried to convince everyone we should give up our search and instead sign up as caravan guards, hoping the bandits would attack us. Martin said that made as much sense as trying to find a bear trap by putting your foot in it. Martin was right, but that didn't keep Daydan and the tracker from snapping at each other over the next couple days. 2 days later, Hesper gave a surprisingly girlish shriek of alarm while bathing. We ran to her assistance, expecting bandits, and instead found Tempe naked, knee-deep in the stream. Hesper stood half-dressed and dripping wet on the shore. Martin thought it was hilarious. Hesper did not. And the only thing that kept Daydan from flying into a rage and attacking Tempe was the fact that he couldn't figure out how to attack a naked man without looking in his direction or actually touching him. The day after that, the weather grew foggy and damp, souring everyone's mood and slowing our search even further. Then it began to rain.
Chapter 89, Losing the Light. The last 4 days had been endlessly overcast and raining. At first, the trees had given us some shelter, but we soon discovered that the leaves overhead merely held the rain, and the slightest stir of wind sent down showers of heavy drops that had been gathering for hours. This meant that whether or not it was currently raining, we were constantly dripped upon and damp. Stories after supper had stopped. Martin caught a cold, and as it worsened, he grew sullen and sarcastic. And 2 days ago, the bread had gotten wet. This might sound like a small thing, but if you've ever tried to eat a piece of wet bread after a day of walking in the rain, you know what sort of mood it puts you in. Daydan had grown truly unmanageable. He balked and complained at the simplest of tasks. The last time he had gone into town for supplies, he had bought a bottle of dreg instead of potatoes, butter, and bowstrings. Hespa left him behind at Crossin, and he didn't get back to camp until nearly midnight, stinking drunk and singing loud enough to make the dead cover their ears. I didn't bother telling him off. Sharp as my trooper's tongue was, he was obviously immune to it. Instead, I waited until he passed out, poured the remaining dreg on the fire, and left the bottle sitting in the coals for him to see. After that, he stopped his constant derogatory muttering about me and settled into chilly silence. While the quiet was nice, I knew it was a bad sign. Given everyone's rising temper, I decided each of us would search for trail sign on our own. This was partly because walking in someone's footsteps over wet turf was a sure way to tear up the ground and leave a trail, but the other reason is that I knew if I sent Daydan and Hespa out together, their eventual argument would alert any bandit within 10 miles. I came back to camp dripping wet and miserable. It turns out the boots I'd bought in Severin didn't have a lick of waterproofing, so they drank rainwater like sponges. In the evening, I could dry them out using the heat of the fire and a little careful sympathy, but as soon as I took 3 steps, they were soaked through again. So on top of everything, my feet had been cold and damp for days. It was our 29th day in the Eld, and when I came over the tiny ridge that hid our latest camp, I saw Daydan and Hespa sitting on opposite sides of the fire, ignoring each other. Hespa was oiling her sword. Daydan was idly jabbing the ground in front of him with a pointed stick. I wasn't in much mood for conversation myself. Hoping the silence held, I went wordlessly to the fire. Except, there was no fire.
"What happened to the fire?" I asked stupidly.
What had happened was rather obvious. It had been left to burn down to charred sticks and damp ashes.
"It's not my turn to get wood," Hespa said pointedly.
Daydan poked at the dirt with his stick. I noticed the beginnings of a bruise high on his cheek. All I wanted in the world was a little something hot to eat and 10 minutes with dry feet. It wouldn't make me happy, but it would bring me closer to happy than I'd been all day.
"I'm surprised the two of you can piss without help," I spat.
Daydan glared up at me.
"Just what do you mean by that?"
When Alvaron asked me to do this job for him, he implied I would have adults helping me, not a handful of school children. Daydan snapped.
"You don't know what she..."
I cut him off.
"I don't care! I don't care what you're bickering about. I don't care what she threw at you. I care that the fire is out. Talu above, a trained dog would be more help."
Daydan's expression firmed into a familiar belligerence.
"Maybe if..."
"Shut up," I said. "I would rather listen to a jackass braying than waste my time with whatever you're saying. When I come back to camp, I expect fire and a meal. If this is beyond you, I'll arrange to have some 5-year-old come out from Crossin and babysit the both of you."
Daydan stood. The wind gusted in the trees above us, sending down heavy drops to patter on the ground.
"You're on your way to a meal you won't be able to stomach, boy."
His hands clenched into fists, and I reached into my pocket to grip the mommet I had made of him 2 days ago. I felt my stomach clench in fear and fury. "Daydan, if you take a single step toward me, I will lay such pain on you that you will scream for me to kill you." I stared him square in the eye. "Right now, I am irritated. Do not even think of making me angry." He paused, and I could almost hear him thinking of every story he had ever heard about Tabrilin the Great, fire and lightning. There was a moment of long silence as the two of us stared at each other, unblinking. Luckily, at this point, Tempe returned to camp, breaking the tension. Feeling a little foolish, I went to the embers of the fire to see if I could rekindle it. Daydan stomped into the trees, hopefully in search of wood. At this point, I didn't care if it was Rennell or not. Tempe sat by the side of the dead fire. Perhaps if I hadn't been busy, I might have noticed something odd in his movement. Then again, perhaps not. Even for a semi-educated barbarian such as myself, the moods of the Adem are difficult to read. As I coaxed the fire slowly back to life, I began to regret how I had handled things. That thought alone kept me from lashing out at Daydan when he returned with an armload of wet wood and dropped it at the edge of my newly rebuilt fire, scattering it. Martin came back shortly after I had rebuilt the fire a second time. He settled at the edge of it and spread his hands. His eyes were sunken and dark. "Feeling any better?" I asked him.
"Loads."
His voice rasped wetly in his chest, sounding worse than it had this morning. I worried about the sound of his breathing, about pneumonia, about fever. "I can mix you a tea that will make your throat a little easier," I suggested without much hope. He'd rejected all my offers of help over the last several days. He hesitated, then nodded. As I was heating the water, he had a fit of violent coughing that lasted nearly a minute. If the rain didn't stop tonight, we would have to head into town and wait for him to recover. I couldn't risk him catching pneumonia or giving away our position to bandit sentries with a coughing fit. I handed him his tea, and Tempe stirred in his seat by the edge of the fire.
"I killed two men today," he said.
There was a long moment of stunned silence. Rain pattered on the ground around us. The fire hissed and spat.
"What?"
I asked incredulously.
"I was attacked by two men behind trees," Tempe said calmly.
I rubbed the back of my neck. "Damn it, Tempe! Why didn't you say something before?" He gave me a level look, and his fingers made an unfamiliar circle.
"It is not easy to kill two men," he said.
"Are you hurt?"
Hespa asked. Tempe turned his cool look on her next. Offended. I'd misunderstood his previous comment. It wasn't the fight itself he had found difficult. It was the fact that he had killed two men.
"I have needed this time to settle my thoughts. Also, I wait to when all are here."
I tried to remember the gesture for apology, but I had to settle for sorrow instead. "What happened?" I asked calmly, as I fingered the frayed ends of my patience. Tempe paused to choose his words.
"I was trying to find trail when two men jump out from trees."
"What do they look like?"
Daydan asked, beating me to the question. Another pause.
"One your size. His arms longer than mine, stronger than me, but slow. Slower than you."
Daydan's expression darkened, as if he couldn't decide if he had been insulted.
"The other was smaller and quicker. Both their swords were broad and thick, edged on both sides. This long."
He held his hands perhaps 3 feet apart. I thought the description revealed more about Tempe than the men he fought.
"Where did it happen? How long ago?"
He pointed in the direction we had been searching.
"Less than 1 mile. Less than 1 hour.
Do you think they were waiting for you?"
"They weren't there when I came through,"
Martin said defensively. He gave a wet, tearing cough deep in his chest and spat something thick under the ground.
"If they were waiting, they couldn't have been waiting long."
Tempe gave an eloquent shrug.
"What sort of armor did they have?"
Daydan asked. Tempe was quiet for a moment, then reached out to tap my boot.
"This?"
"Leather," I suggested. He nodded.
"Leather. Hard and with some metal."
Daydan relaxed a bit.
"That's something, at least,"
he mused, then looked up sharply at Hespa.
"What? What was that look you just gave me?"
"I wasn't looking at you,"
Hespa said frostily.
"You were so. You rolled your eyes."
He looked at Martin.
"You saw her roll her eyes, didn't you?"
"Shut up,"
I snarled at the two of them. Surprisingly, things grew quiet. I pressed the heels of my hands to my eyes and gave our situation a moment of uninterrupted thought. "Martin, how much light do we have left?" He looked up at the slate-colored sky.
"About another hour and a half like this,"
he rasped.
enough to track in.
Then, maybe a quarter hour of bad light after that. The sun will go down quick behind these clouds.
Do you feel up to a little more running around today? I asked. His grin surprised me.
If we can find these bastards tonight, let's do it. They've kept me tramping around this godforsaken place long enough.
I nodded, reached out, and took a pinch of damp ash from the pitifully small fire. I rubbed it between my fingers thoughtfully, then wiped it onto a small rag and tucked it into my cloak. It wouldn't be a good source of heat, but anything was better than nothing. All right, I said. Tempe will lead us to the bodies. Then we'll see if we can trail them back to their camp. I stood up.
Whoa, Daydan said, holding out his hands. What about us?
You and Hespa stay here and guard the camp. I bit my tongue to keep from adding, and try to keep the fire from going out.
Why? Let's all go. We can take care of them tonight.
He got to his feet. And what if there's a dozen of them? I asked in my best scathing tones. He paused, but didn't back down.
We'll have the element of surprise.
We won't have the element of surprise if all five of us go tramping around, I said hotly.
Why are you going then?
Daydan demanded.
It could just be Tempe and Martin.
I'm going because I need to see what we're up against. I'm the one that's going to be making the plan that will get us through this alive.
Why should Greenwood like you be making a plan at all?
We're losing the light,
Martin interjected wearily.
Blessed Talu, a voice of reason speaks. I looked at Daydan. We are going. You are staying. That is an order.
An order?
Daydan echoed with dark incredulity. We eyed each other dangerously for a moment. Then I turned and followed Tempe into the trees. Thunder growled through the sky above us. A wind moved through the trees, clearing away the endless drizzle. In its place, a steady rain began to fall. Chapter 90. To Sing a Song About. Tempe lifted the pine boughs that covered the two men. Laid carefully on their backs, they looked as if they were sleeping. I knelt at the side of the larger one, but before I could get a better look, I felt a hand on my shoulder. Looking back, I saw Tempe shaking his head.
What?
I asked. We had less than an hour of light left. Hunting down the bandits' camp without getting caught was going to be difficult enough. Doing it in a pitch-black storm would be a nightmare.
You should not, he said, firm, serious. Troubling the dead is not of the Lethani.
I need to know about our enemies. I can learn things from them that will help us. His mouth almost frowned. Disapproval.
Magic?
I shook my head. Looking only. I pointed to my eyes, then tapped my temple. Thinking. Tempe nodded. But as I turned back to the bodies, I felt his hand on my shoulder again.
You must ask. They are my dead.
You already agreed, I pointed out.
Asking is the right thing, he said.
I took a deep breath. May I look at your dead, Tempe? He nodded once, formally. I looked over to where Martin was giving his bowstring a careful inspection under a nearby tree. Do you want to see if you can find their trail? He nodded and pushed himself away from the tree. I'd start over there. I pointed to the south between two ridges.
I know my business, he said as he walked off, shouldering his bow.
Tempe took a couple steps away, and I turned my attention to the bodies. One was actually quite a bit larger than Daydan, a great bull of a man. They were older than I had expected, and their hands had the calluses that mark long years of working with weapons. These were not disgruntled farm boys. These were veterans.
I've got the trail,
Martin said, startling me. I hadn't heard the sound of him approaching over the low susurrus of the falling rain.
It's clear as day,
A drunk priest could follow it.
There was a flicker of lightning across the sky and an accompanying grumble of thunder. The rain started to come down harder. I frowned and pulled the tinker's sodden cloak tighter around my shoulders. Martin tilted his head up and let the rain fall full on his face.
I'm glad this weather is finally doing us some good, he said. The more it rains, the easier it will be for us to sneak in and away from their camp.
He wiped his hands on his dripping shirt and shrugged.
Besides, it's not like we can get any wetter than we already are.
You have a point, I said, standing. Tempe covered the bodies with the branches, and Martin led us away to the south. Martin knelt to examine something on the ground, and I took the opportunity to catch up with him. We're being followed, I said, not bothering to whisper it. They were at least 70 feet behind us, and the rain was rolling through the trees with a noise like waves against the shore. He nodded and pretended to point at something on the ground.
I didn't think you'd seen them.
I smiled and stripped water from my face with a wet hand. You're not the only one here with eyes. How many do you think there are?
2. Maybe 3.
Tempe drew close to us. 2, he said with certainty in his voice. I only saw 1, I admitted. How close are we to their camp?
No guess. Could be over the next hill. Could be miles off. There are still just these 2 sets of tracks, and I can't smell any fires.
He stood up and started to follow the trail again without looking back. I pushed a low branch aside as Tempe walked past and caught a glimpse of movement behind us that had nothing to do with wind or rain. Let's go over this next ridge and set a little trap.
Sounds like the very thing, Martin agreed.
Gesturing for us to wait, Martin crouched low and edged his way up to the top of the small rise. I fought the urge to look behind us while he peered over the lip of the ridge, then scampered over. There was a bright flash as lightning struck nearby. The thunder was like a fist in my chest. I startled. Tempe stood.
This is like of home, he said, smiling faintly.
He made no attempt to keep the water from his face. Martin waved, and we stalked over the top of the ridge. Once we were out of sight of whoever was following us, I looked around quickly. Keep following the tracks up to that twisted spruce, then circle back, I gestured. Tempe hides there. Martin, behind that fallen tree. I'll go behind that stone. Martin will make the first move. Use your judgment, but it would probably be best if you waited until they were past that broken stump. Try to leave one of them alive, if possible, but we can't have them getting away or making too much noise.
What will you be doing?
Martin asked as we hurried to lay down a clear set of tracks as far as the twisted spruce tree. I'll be staying out of the way. The 2 of you are better equipped for this sort of thing, but I have a trick or 2 if it comes to that. We reached the tree. Ready? Martin seemed a little startled by my sudden barrage of orders, but they both nodded and went quickly to their places. I circled around and settled behind a lumpish upcrop of stone. From my vantage, I could see our muddy footprints mingling with the trail we followed. Past that, I saw Tempe position himself behind the trunk of a thick burl oak. To his right, Martin knocked an arrow, drew the string back to his shoulder, and waited, motionless as a statue. I brought out the rag that held the pinch of ash and a slender piece of iron, holding them ready in my hand. My stomach churned as I thought about what we had been sent here to do, hunt and kill men. True, they were outlaws and murderers, but men nonetheless. I deepened my breathing and tried to relax. The surface of the stone was chill and gritty against my cheek. I strained my ears, but couldn't hear anything over the steady drumming of the rain. I fought the urge to lean farther around the edge of the stone and broaden my field of vision. Lightning flashed again, and I was counting the seconds until the thunder, when I saw a pair of figures slink into view. I felt a sudden heat flare up in my chest.
Shoot them, Martin!
I said loudly. Daydan whirled around and was facing me with his sword drawn by the time I stepped from my hiding place. Hespa was a little more restrained and stopped with her sword halfway out of its scabbard. I put my knife away and walked to within a half dozen steps of Daydan. The thunder rolled over us as I caught and held his eyes. His expression was defiant, and I didn't bother to disguise my anger. After a long minute of silence, he looked away, pretending he needed to brush the water from his eyes. "Put that away," I nodded to his sword. After a second's hesitation, he did so. Only then did I slide the thin piece of brittle steel I held back into the lining of my cloak. "If we were bandits, you would already be dead." I moved my gaze from Daydan to Hespa and back again. "Go back to camp." Daydan's expression twisted. "I'm sick of you talking to me like I'm a kid." He jabbed a finger toward me. "I've been in this world a lot longer than you. I'm not stupid." I bit down several angry responses that couldn't help but make matters worse. "I don't have time to argue with you. We're losing the light and you're putting us in danger. Go back to camp."
"We should take care of this tonight," he said. "We've already knackered off two of them. There's probably only five or six left. We'll surprise them in the dark, in the middle of the storm. Wham! Bam! We'll be back in Crossing tomorrow for lunch."
"And what if there's a dozen of them? What if there's 20? What if they're holed up in a farmhouse? What if they find our camp while no one's there? All our supplies, our food, and my loot could be gone, and a trap waiting for us when we come back. All because you couldn't sit still for an hour." His face reddened dangerously, and I turned away. "Go back to camp. We'll talk about this tonight."
"No, damn it! I'm coming, and there's not a damn thing you can do to stop me."
I ground my teeth. The worst part was that it was true. I had no way of enforcing my authority. There was nothing I could do short of subduing him with the wax simulacra I'd made. And I knew that to be the worst possible option. Not only would it turn Daydan into an outright enemy, it would undoubtedly turn Hespa and Martin against me too. I looked to Hespa. "Why are you here?" She darted a quick look at Daydan.
"He was going to go alone. I thought it was better if we stayed together. And we did think it through. Nobody's going to stumble under the camp. We hid our gear and doused the fire before we left."
I gave a tight sigh and tucked the useless pinch of ash into a pocket of my cloak. Of course they did.
"But I agree," she said. "We should try to finish it tonight."
I looked to Martin. He gave me an apologetic look.
"I'd be lying if I said I didn't want this over," he said, and then added quickly, "if we can do it smart."
He might have said more, but the words caught in his throat, and he began to cough. I looked at Tempe. Tempe looked back. The worst thing was, my gut agreed with Daydan. I wanted this done. I wanted a warm bed and a decent meal. I wanted to get Martin somewhere dry. I wanted to go back to Severin where I could bask in Alvaron's gratitude. I wanted to find Denna, apologize, and explain why I had left without a word. Only a fool fights the tide. "Fine," I looked up at Daydan. "If one of your friends dies because of this, it will be your fault." I saw a flicker of uncertainty cross his face, then disappear as he set his jaw. He had said too much for his pride to let him back down. I leveled a long finger at him. "But from now on, each of you must do as I say. I'll listen to your suggestions, but I give the orders." I looked around. Martin and Tempe nodded right away, with Hespa following only a second after. Daydan gave a slow nod. I looked at him. "Swear it." His eyes narrowed. "If you pull another stunt like this when we're attacking tonight, you could get us killed. I don't trust you. I'd rather leave tonight than go into this with someone I can't trust." There was another tense moment, but before it stretched too long, Martin chimed in.
"Come on, Den. The boy's actually got a fair bit on the ball. He set up this little ambush in about 4 seconds.
His tone turned jocular.
"Besides, he's not as bad as that bastard Brenway,
and the money for that little privy dance wasn't half as good.
Daydan cracked a smile.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. So long as it's over tonight.
I didn't doubt for a second Daydan would still go his own way if it's